my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. People have always considered the power to predict the future somehow magical. What if we could predict the world's financial markets? Our guest, Doan Farmer, and his colleague, Norman Packard, set out to do precisely that. But their foundation was not magic. It was science. Doan Farmer is a physicist turned entrepreneur who thinks of himself as a scientist. He dreams of understanding the big picture. It's an idea that stretches back to before Darwin formulated how evolution works, back to Herbert Spencer.
Science is a process of chipping away little pieces at a time, and what I'm doing is really very modest, but the dream would be Spencer's dream, and putting some real mathematical rigor and more concrete understanding behind that so that we could really use this in a very tangible way to understand why the immune system is like a social system, is like an economy, and how it's different. And maybe understand some broader design principles to help us think about those things and help us engineer them too.
Doan Farmer earned his PhD in physics from the University of California at Santa Cruz, where he was part of the group who formulated chaos theory. They also became infamous in Las Vegas for almost beating the house at roulette. Then Doan Farmer spent 10 years as an award-winning scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratories. He and Norman Packard founded Prediction Company, intent on predicting the world's financial markets. After almost a decade and considerable success, Mr. Farmer the entrepreneur is again Dr. Farmer the physicist. He's a faculty member at the Santa Fe Institute studying financial markets as an example of complex systems. Bill Russell and I sat down with Doan Farmer in his office in Santa Fe, New Mexico, delighted to have a glimpse into this fascinating man's complex world. Doan Farmer, looking forward to this conversation, I kept thinking, you know, the world feels chaotic to a lot of us, but we have corrupted that concept. I almost feel as if I've come to the source. Will you please help me bring order to the concept of chaos? You've been doing this a long time.
Well, I've tried, but, you know, the way in which mathematicians and physicists talk about chaos is really not the one that we commonly associate with the word, though it's also not without any connection at all. The fascination for that, for me, when I was a graduate student, was the idea that some equations that were deterministic could generate properties that were very much almost impossible to distinguish from those of something that was just random, and that everything could be determined so that each condition leads exactly to the next as Newton told us it should be, and yet the trajectories of these systems are so complicated and folded up that for most intents and purposes things look random.
So life doesn't necessarily imitate art and science here?
No, life doesn't imitate art and science, though it has turned out that in life and in many other places, you do find examples where this deterministic concept of chaos seems to play an important role.
And we will talk about that. Bill Russell and I are in Santa Fe, New Mexico with Doan Farmer, and we're going to be back in just a moment with more of the Paula Gordon Show, a lot more. Please be with us when we return. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Doan Farmer is our guest. Bill Russell and I are with him in Santa Fe, and Bill has this I want to talk look already.
Chaos. This is sort of ancient history. You and others get a lot of credit when you were in graduate school at UC Santa Cruz.
University of California.
Of beginning to make order of chaos or make sense of chaos, even allowing for the difference between the normal use of the word and the technical use of the word, one still has to wonder what utility chaos has. And apparently it has a great deal, but it's not obvious to those of us who are uninitiated.
Well, I think that the first and foremost utility is just in understanding the world around us. there are many phenomena in nature, such as turbulence in fluids, waterfalls being a classic example, where the conditions can be fixed. The bed of the stream is not changing. There's nothing obvious that's really varying in time. And yet, water going over a waterfall splashes in an unpredictable manner that seems to almost have a mind of its own. To a physicist, this is really baffling, or was really baffling, because what's making it decide to do that? Why is it first doing this and then that? And so, actually, very many different people independently came up with this concept that what's going on is that the physical system is amplifying tiny little, any little noise fluctuations that are there. So the splashing of the water in the waterfall could be determined by the way the wind happens to be blowing today, or, to use a classic metaphor, a butterfly flapping its wings could be influencing the fact that this splash happened on this rock instead of that rock. When we were in graduate school, this idea was around, but, well, let me say it had been worked on by mathematicians. There was some theory, but it seemed like a vague qualitative thing that was hard to connect to reality. And the part of the problem that I think we made our most important contributions to was in understanding how do you go from an experiment, say a physicist who set up a fluid flow in his lab and is seeing some swirls that are fluctuating around in time, how can you draw a picture of what's going on? How can you connect the data to the theory? So we did a lot of work trying to come up with ways to make that connection. Actually using analog computers as little test physical systems, pretending that we threw away most of the information about what was going on, and then we did things to try and reconstruct what was happening.
A minor detour here. Digital computers are what people are accustomed to. You are the first person out of 200 and however many at the moment to talk about analog computers, a concept that Bill introduced to me many years ago, but nobody talks about analog computers.
They are still near and dear to my heart.
Tell us what an analog computer is, because really, truly, most people have no clue that you can do it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, an analog computer takes advantage of the fact that there are many physical systems that seem to obey the same equations. Some of you took physics might, you know, have encountered the analogy between electrical systems and mechanical systems. You can find electrical systems that mimic any mechanical system. And really, it turns out any just about any equations that you can think up, you can find some kind of straight electrical analog. So rather than using a binary representation of numbers as you do in a digital computer and flipping bits, you just have a voltage in an analog computer that might vary, say, from minus 5 volts to plus 5 volts, and you take the smallest thing that would ever happen and call that minus 5 volts and the biggest thing that would ever happen and call it plus 5 volts and mock up an electrical circuit so that these voltages change in time. Using capacitors and resistors and amplifiers.
Inductors.
And inductors. I mean, whatever.
Whatever works.
Yeah, whatever works. And you have an analog of the equations that you're trying to solve,
Do you do that?
Well, you do that because you're interested in solving the equations. You want to. You have, say, a physical system like a fluid flow, and you have some idea about some equations that describe it. And you create an electrical circuit that mocks those equations in some way. Yet, because it's electricity, you can perhaps simulate it hundreds of times faster than you could with the system itself. It's in your laboratory, so you can control it easily. You can change the resistors back and forth to vary the parameters. We used analog computers because back in those days, digital computers were still pretty slow, and we could simulate things in real time. and watch the solutions on the screen or even listen to them on the screen.
Well, it also saves the hassle of getting from analog to digital and then digital back to analog, which can be a challenging process and requires instrumentation and all sorts of other things.
Though we actually built analog to digital converters so that we could reduce the data to digital form and analyze it with our microcomputers.
Well, I don't want to beat this to death, but why don't we use analog computers anymore?
Well, digital computers have gotten pretty fast, and they're pretty convenient to use. Analog computers, it's a different art. It can be a hassle because, for example, you think you're simulating things in the right way, and you hit plus 5 volts, and that's as much voltage as your system will take, and it just flattens out on you. So you have to go back and play around with your capacitors and resistors and rescale everything.
That sounds like fun, but maybe not real
productive. Not when you're trying to solve a problem.
You spoke just in passing of the butterfly. Now, I think an awful lot of people, and again, it is interesting to me to watch science get corrupted into the public domain, if you will. A lot of people have heard about the butterfly effect. But when you talk about the butterfly effect, you're talking as a physicist, you're talking as a person who has worked both in the real world and in the theoretical world. This has a very special meaning to you, doesn't it?
Well, it's special in a couple of ways. Actually, I don't quite know where this came from. The rumor is that Ed Lorenz, who was a meteorologist who came up with the idea of deterministic chaos, was one of the people who did, that he said something about this. Now, it also happens that Lorenz's attractor, his chaotic attractor, looks kind of like a butterfly. It's like two sheets that are folding back on themselves, and it looks like it has wings, like a butterfly's wings. And so it's at least possible that that has something to do with that instead of a dragonfly or housefly some other small thing that might create a little perturbation that could be enormously amplified by just physics.
That's the larger truth, isn't it? A little something happens and a lot of something else happens.
That's right. That's right. You have a system that, because of often some abstract space, there's stretching going on and folding. So the stretching takes small things and stretches them out and makes them bigger. The folding folds them back down so they don't just blow off and go to infinity. And underneath the hood, in a turbulent fluid flow, that's what's causing the splashing and fuming or the waterfall as it changes in time.
What I think you're describing is the work you've done and others have done is another part of the tool set that physicists need to understand the real world. And then from that building to an appreciation of the kinds of events that we hadn't been able to get our hands around before, that seems like it's one piece of it. We were talking about computers. It also seems that having computers available has opened up opportunities to deal with complex systems in a generic sense, but also for us to be able to better understand them by virtue of having them visually represented to us. And it seems a sort of a continuity from what you did, starting with chaos and the representations of that, on into the kinds of applications that you've been working with since then.
This is a 30-year stretch, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I started working on these kind of things in about 1977. So that's a while ago, 23 years.
Think about the answer to his question, if you will, as we go to a break. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are with Doan Farmer. We are in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we're all going to be back in just a moment. We are back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell had just posed some assertions, if not a question, and they are directed toward Doan Farmer, who can either respond or ask Bill to clarify that.
Well, I mean, I think that chaos, I mean, the discovery of chaos already illustrates that it really relates to the real world. It originally came from Poincaré, who was trying to understand what's called the three-body problem in celestial mechanics. That is, we understand the orbits pretty well when you just have two bodies, like, say, the Earth and the Sun, but you throw in something else like Jupiter, and what happens? Now, classical techniques couldn't solve those problems. Nowadays, you can solve them with a computer. But Poincaré wasn't daunted by that, plunged in, and he realized that in the presence of a third body, things got a lot more complicated. And he was worried about the stability of the solar system. That is, can a planet just fly off and never come back? Turns out that once there are three bodies involved, it's something that you should worry about because it might happen.
Is it something I should worry about?
No, you probably don't need to worry about
that today.
Thank you.
But it does turn out, simulations have since shown, that if you really make long-time simulations of the outer planets, that they're chaotic, and that puts a fundamental limit on how far into the future we can predict. Turns out the limit's several million years. So
this is very striking because you know that sort of strikes at the heart of what we think of as a Newtonian universe. I mean, you're describing very simple physical systems that in theory and practice more or less conform to what we think of as Darwin's, Newton's laws. And you should, you know, an isolated system, just three bodies, we should be able to know everything there is to know about that from today forever forward. And you're telling me it ain't true.
No, it's not true because down there somewhere, there's always something creating some uncertainty, even though those uncertainties might be tiny. If nothing else, quantum mechanics makes our measurements uncertain. And so what chaos says is those tiny uncertainties get amplified, and they get amplified to the point where they get amplified so much, or exponential growth is so strong that no matter how tiny, it eventually becomes important.
So this is not just a computational problem. It's not just the arithmetic of these three bodies interacting with one another. There is something else going on.
Yeah, because there's a fundamental limit to how accurately we can measure something. And it turns out because the amplification of errors is exponential, that even if you double the accuracy of the measurements, that may only gain you a tiny increment more predictability going forward in time. So let's say you could predict a million years by measuring the position of the planets to a certain accuracy. Double the accuracy of the measurements, you might get up to a million in 10 years. And that means that you eventually hit a solid wall, which is the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. It goes back to Laplace originally said, you know, give me the position and velocity of every particle in the universe, and I can predict the behavior of the universe for the rest of time. The combination of quantum mechanics and chaos tell you that Laplace couldn't do that.
It is interesting to hear you talk about these things in terms of prediction, because here you are, a physicist, sitting in the midst of the Santa Fe Institute, and yet you spent 10 years of your life with something that you and your partners named the Prediction Company, presumably on the premise that there were some things you could predict, and they were very real, and they were within financial markets. Join those two thoughts for me. Okay, you can predict, you cannot predict, but you can predict, but you can't predict.
Well, I guess, first of all, let me just say that we didn't name ourselves the excellent prediction company.
Not even the pretty good prediction
company? No, we just named ourselves prediction company, leaving the adjectives out.
Not even so, correct prediction.
But let me come back to that, because it's true that my career has bounced back and forth between prediction and chaos and other things. In graduate school, got interested, together with Norman Packard, in the problem of predicting the motion of roulette balls, noting that a roulette ball is just a classical physical system, rolling ball on a circular track with friction. It's an elementary physics problem to write down an equation for that and solve it.
It's not just boys who like to go to Las Vegas. Huh?
Well, maybe it was also boys who like to go to Las Vegas. But it meant, in principle at least, we realized we could just measure the position and velocity of the ball, make a prediction about where the ball was going to go, place our bets before the croupier closed them, and make a lot of money from Las Vegas. Well, that led to a long saga, but it meant that when in graduate school we heard about the work Poincaré and Lorentz and others had done, and chaos, we were very primed to understand what it was all about. In fact, roulette was one of the examples Poincaré had given of how you could take something that's deterministic in the Newtonian sense, and yet it would be a classic example of randomness. And so then we went to studying this from in a more academic setting, getting our PhDs completed.
You were at Los Alamos complex adaptive systems group.
That's true.
I have a very checkered career, my friend.
And then that kind of backed me into the second chapter of applied prediction. I came up with some interesting ways to make forecasts that were driven by the idea that if you're looking at something in nature and you're seeing random behavior that's driven by some fairly simple chaotic deterministic system, well, ultimately the behavior is random. Over a short term, that's not true. Over a short term, it should be predictable. And so there is an important difference there. And if you recognize that difference, and if you make your models in just the right way, perhaps even with just the data, without understanding what's really going on, you can make an empirical time series model. That is one that just takes the data, does some things with the data to make a model from nothing, in a way, except the data, and makes forecasts going forward. So John Sidorowicz and I originally did this, and we were applying it to people's fluid flow experiments, and then we started looking at more biologically related data and ice ages and sunspot cycles and things like this. But when I would speak about it, some clown in the audience would always raise his hand and say, well, have you tried applying this to the stock market?
If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Is that the line?
Exactly. And at a certain point, I realized I'd been at Los Alamos almost 10 years, and it seemed like time to do something new. So we started a company and did try applying this stuff to the stock market.
You did that for a long time.
For 8 years.
How did it come out?
It came out pretty well. I'm kind of retired to the Santa Fe Institute now. But the company's doing well, and I'm glad to say progressing well without me at this point.
If you are willing, talk a little bit more about the prediction company, because this business of being able to look at something as complex as financial markets in the world at large fascinates everybody. And your ability to at least make some dent in that is quite an achievement.
Well, and every culture, I think, has a myth of the profit, or some sense, some function in the culture that has the ability to look ahead and either control or at least be able to see into the future. And what you're saying sounds like, you know, you've found the holy grail of human culture, which is to be able to see the future and maybe even do something about it.
And put a dollar sign on it.
as a trivial subset.
That would be an exaggeration. I mean,
it was not the excellent prediction company.
Yeah. We, you know, what we were able to predict is very limited and really very weak. We took advantage of the fact that you don't have to be able to predict very well in a financial market to make a pretty decent amount of money. If you're right 55% of the days, then you've got something that comes out to be better than what most other investors can do. And that's not a very good forecast, though. I mean, with the weather, for example, which none of us are happy with forecasts of the weather, they do a lot better than that.
So you're just saying you have to win more than you lose?
We have to win more than we lose. We have to do so in a way that's consistent enough to be statistically significant.
Go ahead.
Well, go ahead.
You.
You're the one.
Well, the thing is, it's easy to get lucky and have a run of a day or two where you make a good bet and you make some money. What's not easy. And what much more difficult is to do something that you can demonstrate is sufficiently consistent that the odds that it would have happened are very low. The odds that would have happened just at random by sheer blind dumb luck are very low, so that you really are able to demonstrate that you're able to predict. The noise is so overwhelming in financial markets that it's very hard to find the signal sitting down inside all that noise. I would say the strength of the signals that we found at Prediction Company were generally the order of a 20th of the size of the noise that they were sitting in.
Let's come back in just a minute with Doan Farmer. We are at the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Bill Russell and I have joined him. We're all going to be back in just a moment. Be with us when we return. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell and I are here in Santa Fe, New Mexico with Doan Farmer. And we were talking about signal to noise. Why are you doing that? Tell me about signals and noises and financial markets.
Well, the signal in this case, and say for a stock, would be the part that you're able to predict, the part that has a pattern to it. The noise is the stuff that's just random that you can't hope to predict anything about. And, you don't have to look at stock prices very long to realize they're pretty darn random. We were able to find some signals down there going against the classic efficient markets theory and economics, but those signals are pretty weak. So to first approximation, those guys were right. The economists, the neoclassical economists were correct, and markets are, as far as we could tell, pretty unpredictable. The second approximation, no, there are some signals down there, but you have to look long and hard. You have to know what you're doing. You probably need to look in some ways that haven't, go down some paths that haven't been really well trodden. In our experience, we had to look at an awful lot of data. We were helped by the fact that there are thousands of different stocks that you can think about predicting, 30 years of data, daily timescale, 250 trading days a year. That adds up to many millions of data points that you can look through. Looking for patterns that, if something particular happens, the earnings go up, the price goes down, the volume goes up, then does the price of the stock go up or down?
And the answer is...
Well, the answer, I don't even know about the one I just threw out. The answer is there are some things like that when you see those patterns occur, when those signals happen, 55% of the time the stock goes up and 45% of the time it goes down. So while it's by no means a sure thing, it's worth making a bet on. And you get enough of those bets and you can smooth the ride out and make things nicer. And so really what we did was a very weak form of prediction. We typically didn't really understand where these patterns came from. The patterns weren't really all that strong, but we were able to find enough of them and put them together on enough different things that by betting on thousands of stocks and trading them every day and hedging out all kinds of risk factors that we didn't know anything about, we were able to make something that was at least better than average.
And having the ability to withstand losses. Because if you're going to play at a 45 or 55 or even a 52-48 split, you're going to have some bad days.
Yeah.
The statistics are just going
to... And so you have to be able to ride out those bad days. We also went to some effort to, as I mentioned a moment ago, hedge out the common risks. Yeah. So that, for example, if we don't understand how to predict whether the stock market as a whole is going to go up or down, but we do think we know how to predict whether this stock is going to go up more than that stock, then we do some things to get rid of the market so that if the market crashes, we don't really care too much. Because all we're really interested in looking at is whether Microsoft went up and Sun went down. And And as long as they do that relative to each other, even if the market crashes or soars up,
that doesn't affect us. You're still making money. I would think that part of the challenge in this was to find those things that you should be looking for. You know, what are the, you mentioned three variables, for example, but there are thousands of variables that you would have been dealing with. And I would think a lot of the challenge is just sifting through that quantity of data to find something that it was worth, that could be characterized.
Yeah, that's certainly true. As I mentioned, we went through millions of data points, had a lot of computers helping us do that.
Digital computers.
Yeah, no analog computers here. You know, had a lot of great software people creating the tools to make all this relatively easy, but it was still a long, hard job.
Was it as hard? There's a tendency to criticize theoreticians frequently, legitimately, that, you know, what works in the theoretical doesn't work in the real world. What you did was move from the theoretical, at least, to what is characterized. I'm not sure it is a real world, but some people think of it as a real world. Were you surprised by what you ran into, was it within the domain of what your expectations had been?
Oh, I always have a hard time answering questions like that. It was certainly, there were surprising things. The logistics and mechanics of trading every day turned out to be a lot harder than we thought. It wasn't as hard to get a deal as we thought. We managed to convince several different people in Wall Street that we might be able to do something. So, I don't know, management turned out to be a much bigger challenge than I thought it would be. And certainly, with hindsight, we were pretty cocky and foolish to just blast off and do something like that without knowing anything about it. I think we were lucky it worked out in the end.
But you're describing people things, not the theory being
that's
hard.
True. That's true. And so, you know, I'll first say I originally cut my teeth fixing motorcycles and building circuits when I was in high school. Studied cosmology and astrophysics through college and graduate school. Got seduced by roulette, and then, you know, we were doing experiments. We're putting photocells around roulette wheels. That's when I first learned to program a computer so I could analyze the data.
With your toes?
Well, we used our toes to actually input the clicks to the computer to time the ball so we knew its position and velocity so we could make our predictions.
And you used your toes because the environment was not altogether welcoming of the methodologies you were developing.
That's right. We had to conceal what we were doing, and so the toe was the keyboard.
So you did all of these things headed toward the Los Alamos group was a very serious complex systems group where I have no clue what you were doing there, but it was a long way from motorcycles, and it would seem a fairly long way from cosmology and roulette wheels.
Yeah, although I wouldn't say we were too serious. I mean, we did. I guess we called ourselves a complex systems group because we figured that wouldn't restrict us too much compared with alternatives like life and intelligence group, which we thought might be, you know, cramper style or something. But I maybe was serious, but on the other hand, it was a big playpen. I think Prediction Company was much more serious. We had a major Swiss bank as our client. We were trading large quantities of their money, so they were not happy when we lost
large quantities of their
large quantities of their money. So that did feel a bit serious at times.
Did the science part of it surprise you? I mean, was it harder to achieve the results that you thought you could achieve than you'd expected?
I guess I had a pretty open mind about how hard it was going to be, though the mere fact that I set out to do it without knowing anything about the problem probably illustrates that I was overconfident. It was certainly hard. We found that we had to really look through a lot of data and roll up our sleeves and just work hard to to make it all work.
I know you're not going to tell me any trade secrets, but it seems as if you used, I was going to say threw a lot of tools in it. I don't think that's the case. You used a lot of different tools, genetic algorithms and neural networks and probably 1,000 other kinds of things.
Chaos theory.
Chaos theory, presumably. How did you go about selecting the tools that you were going to apply?
Well, the dominant principle was trial and error.
It's scientific, in a sense.
Actually, oddly enough, chaos theory is one of the things we didn't use, though that may have been the seductress who got us all into it.
Doan Farmer and Norman Packard did not use chaos theory?
No, despite
unbelievable.
Despite what so many journalists say, we're always very careful to tell them that, and they always like to put that back in there. But some of the original forecasting techniques were motivated by work that we'd done in chaos theory. But it's actually very hard to make any definitive statement about whether financial markets have anything to do with chaos theory or not. And it turns out that some of those techniques are still useful, even if things aren't coming from low-dimensional deterministic chaos. And though I would say that the place we ended from where we started was quite different, and we went through a lot of other, we tried an awful lot of things along the way, and we just used the ones that worked and threw away the ones that didn't.
This is Doan Farmer, and we're going to be back in just a moment. And that face you're making, Bill, we will have a chance to let you speak to that. We will return in a moment with Doan Farmer in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Bill Russell and I welcome you being with us when we return. Welcome back. It is the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell is making faces that he wants to talk, and the person to whom he is making those faces is Doan Farmer. We are here at the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Okay, Bill. Okay.
There's a book's been written about the prediction company and a lot of the stories around that, and I found myself reading it and thinking, these guys have sold out. I can see it already. I mean, for all their high intentions and their, you know, all we're really doing is testing the theory, and we want to fully test the theory. You know, can we predict something like financial markets? And I had this sense of a strange attractor in this culture that is money. That is, you know, what draws people and draws the best people. A lot of the best minds in the world are being drawn into financial environments. And you've done a very strange thing. You fooled me. I didn't think you would come back out of that, and you have now stepped back out of that. And I don't know if this, you know, is because you're a noble soul,
or because
you got fed up with it, or what it was. But it's very surprising to see somebody enter into the financial environment, have success, and then step back away from it. Why'd you do that?
Well, I guess I like to have fun. I like to change what I do about every 10 years. It was really interesting doing Prediction Company. It was a great challenge. It was incredibly satisfying to build something that worked, build a machine that sat there, that took in all these inputs from thousands of different places, put them together, made sent thousands of orders to the stock market every day. But on the other hand, I began to feel like a slave to the quarterly objectives and
it was the motorcycle worked, didn't it? Once you put those pieces together and the motorcycle worked, you wanted to ride off into the sunset, didn't you?
Yeah. And I wanted to get back. I've always been fascinated to try and understand why the order and organization and richness that we have in the biological world and our culture exists, and didn't feel that the day-to-day activities at Prediction Company were giving me much time to think about.
Would it be fair to say that looking at the financial market is something that you could then amplify? I'm not using technical terms here. That you can then apply that to other complicated or, as you say, complex systems?
Well, I think so. I think the financial markets are a really interesting example of a complex system. where evolution is actually a very important process, just as it is in biological systems. And I've been trying to develop a theory of financial markets in which traders are the individual organisms. Strategies of traders are like the species that distinguish one group from another. These strategies evolve in time, and that evolution is modulated by profits in much the same way that survival in a biological ecology is modulated by food. And that is the, you know, and the traders that are able to make profits, or the strategies that are able to make profits, are the strategies that get propagated forward. So markets are always evolving and changing in time.
That sounds like a Darwinian description.
Yes, it is. It's a, or a Lamarckian, depending on your...
I haven't heard anybody say anything nice about Lamarck lately.
With one exception.
Distinguish that for us.
Well, Darwin said that innovation happens through random variation, and he was right in biology. But in culture, that's not so clear. In culture, necessity is the mother of invention, and to take the Clausian Lamarckian example of the giraffe looks at the fruit or in the tree and says, well, if I had a longer neck, I could get up there and eat that leaf or fruit or whatever it is. Culture is a much more Lamarckian process in that we can think that we want to do something and we can focus our attention on it and move it in that direction. The pace of innovation is much higher. So that would be one of the differences, one of the obvious differences between biology and economics. But I think that it may turn out that economics is actually just as fertile a place to study evolution as biology, and that by thinking in evolutionary terms, we not only unify biology and economics, but get a better understanding.
Help me with this. You're a physicist talking about economics and biology. Can you do that? Are you licensed to drive those things?
I'm probably not, is the correct answer.
But it's a free country.
And you are at the Santa Fe Institute, where that is one of the hallmarks of what you do here, yes?
That is one of the hallmarks, and I try and find biologists or economists or people who really have made that their lifelong specialty to help me when I get confused on these things.
I'm really asking a very serious question. Is there not a new way of thinking about science that gets out of some of those boxes and lets a physicist bring what he knows to biology and economics and have a richer experience knowing things?
Well, I think what may be a bit new and is perhaps a backlash against the specialization that's become more and more oppressive and universal and science is that maybe we do need a few generalists, bumblers though they may be, to address things at a broader level and try and synthesize them together and try and cross-fertilize, bringing ideas from one area into another area. So perhaps I'm just a dilettante, but that's at least... more acceptable at the Santa Fe Institute than it is in many other places.
We talked about analog computers, which gets to analogies. What you're describing, listening to you, it sounds like within physics you've got some dots, and as a theoretician as an experimentalist confirming the theories, you look at the dots and you try to connect the dots in some sort of significant way. What I'm hearing you say is there's some of the dots that fall outside of the domain that is traditionally considered physics or biology or economics, and that you need those generalists in order to connect the dots outside of that discipline in order to see the kinds of broader patterns that you're talking about.
I like to believe that it helps to have some generalists around to connect those dots. Physics has a long tradition of emigration to other fields. I think it's particularly popular at the moment, in part because physics has backed itself into some pretty difficult corners at this point. I mean, understanding string theories and you know the deep structure of particles in the universe is it's a great thing to do, but it seems that it's hitting some limits, and a lot of physicists are going out and exploring other areas.
I ask about Darwin partly because it has to do with talking to some of your other colleagues. There's a tendency to think of the great man theory. Darwin did Darwin's work and defined forever and ever what Darwinian thinking was. And my impression is that he made a start, but there's a lot more work to be done. And and I'm thinking of genetic algorithms as a simple example of that. But it seems as if some of the questions that have drawn you back into the I won't call it academic, into the research environment, the broad research environment, could be characterized as a mechanism, a means of making more rigorous and perhaps extending the underlying concepts that Darwin presented in the last century.
Yeah, I think actually a better name to throw out would be Herbert Spencer, who's the one who coined the word evolution in this context and actually is responsible for the much abused phrase survival of the fittest. His concept of evolution that he wrote about prior to Darwin was that evolution was a much broader process that involved everything in the universe from the origin of the stars and planets to society. In fact, Spencer went on to be the founder of sociology. So he really viewed these things as all being very closely connected. His cause was greatly boosted by Darwin's, because Darwin, within the sphere of biology, made it all much more precise and really put forth something that was a real scientific theory that had predictive value. But let me say also, Spencer often gets blamed, perhaps as some justification for social Darwinism and some other ideas that were not very good ideas. But there was a broad vision there that evolution is a process driving the organization that we see all around us in many different domains, and that it has a lot in common between these different domains, and that it's an important problem to try and characterize as precisely as possible what that is that is in common, and to get some understanding about this broader mechanism that seems to make us the thinking creatures that we are.
This is Doan Farmer. We are at the Santa Fe Institute. We're going to be back in just a moment for a couple more minutes of the Paula Gordon Show. Please be with us when we return. Welcome back. We have a couple more minutes with Doan Farmer. We are here at the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Bill Russell, of course, is with me. You talk about these big approaches to complex systems being practical. And I think that many people think that economics is about as practical as you can get. Is that where your work continues to fascinate you?
Yeah, though I have to say that the work I'm trying to do now is really more theoretical. It's trying to create a conceptual picture of how markets work and why they have booms and crashes, and why it's the case that they're pretty random, but they're not completely random. Is it natural? I mentioned a while ago that the signal's about a 20th of the noise. I'd like to understand where that comes from. So I'm not worrying about predicting stocks anymore. I'm just trying to think about the big picture of what makes the market tick.
If you know that, will you have unlocked, will that be the key to unlock other complex systems?
Well, it might be. I'd certainly like it if it were.
Are you looking for general big rules?
I am. I'm looking for ways to try and find common threads that go back and forth between all complex systems and help us get a broader picture of how they work.
This sounds as if it is an extension of how you characterized Spencer's work, that those systemic relationships, and then there being some order in that.
Yeah, that's the dream, though. I should emphasize that science is a process of chipping away little pieces at a time, and what I'm doing is really very modest, but the dream would be Spencer's dream, and putting some real mathematical rigor and more concrete understanding behind that, so that we could really use this in a very tangible way to understand why the immune system is like a social system, is like an economy, and how it's different. And maybe understand some broader design principles to help us think about those things and help us engineer them too.
Are you looking for the simple within the complex?
Well, as a scientist, I'm always looking for the simple. That's part of what being indoctrinated as a physicist is all about, is find the simple problem and solve that one first, and then go on to do something just a little bit harder next.
It seems like there is a new science happening that will give us access to all kinds of really unpredictable ways of looking at the world. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, again, I think that's the dream. We don't have a lot of really solid accomplishments like Darwin's theory of evolution or Newton's theory of physics, but there's some incremental progress, and I who knows, it might happen.
We thank you very much for letting us have a peek into this very interested and complex world that you have inhabited. We appreciate your time and your interest.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Doan Farmer, for expanding our sense of complexity, both in theory and in practice. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well. ¶¶